One wonders whose fools the national media are. The focus of my presentation is to outline the connection between law and truth. Admittedly, not a very pithy topic, but then Philadelphia Society gatherings are not known for banal discussions anyway. I begin with two pre-notations. First, with an aim to ward off any criticism from experts in the field of law, I freely admit that my area of expertise is decidedly not civic jurisprudence. Thus, my discussion will attempt to provide a moral and philosophical framework which legal thinkers may apply to the nuances of their own discipline. Secondly, I will address the question before the House from within the natural law tradition, yet with an ecumenical sensitivity. I find that the natural law yields the advantage of providing a common grammar rather than a set of doctrines wherein all participants of goodwill may engage in robust and illuminating dialogue. We live in a confused age. This confusion is most obviously evident in the popular culture, which seeks so feverishly for a sense of meaning and intimacy, yet so often ends up senselessly isolated instead. In this regard, the culture reminds us of the man described by St. Augustine, who even in knocking on the brothel door may still be seeking God. This confusion, which is not less energetic for a lack of sense of purpose and clarity, is merely the manifestation of a deeper confusion emanating from the fields of philosophy, politics, and law. And it is to this area that I wish to direct some of my reflections today. In particular, this confusion has spread to the legal profession and to those whose efforts could be called the philosophy of law. Lawyers and laymen are confronted with a series of questions, some of which Jean has outlined. What is going on within our criminal justice system? Can we have law in a lawless society? What do we do with clients known to be guilty? What becomes of law in a profession wherein the authentic meaning of truth is questioned? Do the procedures of the system pervert the very goals of the system? These critical and timely concerns may be summed up in the question, what indeed is the relationship between law and truth? I believe that a loss of a clear sense of philosophical ideas brought about by an encroaching relativism so dominant in our day and age, and a detachment of whatever philosophical ideas that remain from their moorings have reverberated to the field of law, blurring the understanding of truth as well as the role of the state in human relationships. In the Platonic dialogue, Theaetetus, we have a wide-ranging discussion on the nature of human knowledge, its subversion, its reliability, and its grounding. In one exchange between Socrates and Theaetetus, we find the following selection of interest to our topic. Socrates: what is one to say knowledge is? Theaetetus: true knowledge is belief. Surely there can be at least no mistake in believing what is true, and the consequences are always satisfactory. Socrates: you will find a whole profession to prove that true belief is not knowledge. Theaetetus: how so? What profession? Socrates: the profession of those paragons of intellect known as orators and lawyers. There you have men who use their skill to produce conviction not by instruction, but by making people believe whatever they want them to believe. You can hardly imagine teachers so clever as to be able, in the short time allowed by the clock, to instruct their hearers thoroughly in the true facts of a case of robbery or other violence, which those hearers have not witnessed. Theaetetus: no, I cannot imagine that. But they can convince them. Socrates: and by convincing you mean making them believe something? Theaetetus: of course. And when a jury is rightly convicted of facts which can be known only by eyewitnesses, then, judging by hearing and accepting a true belief, they are judging without knowledge, although if they find the right verdict, their conviction is correct? Theaetetus: certainly. Socrates: but if true belief and knowledge were the same thing, the best of jurymen could never have a correct belief without knowledge. It now appears that they must be different things. Close quote. This conversation serves to underscore the confusion between persuasion, opinion, and truth. The distinction between these things is blurred in our subjectivist day. Truth has been reduced to mere opinion, with no one opinion necessarily any better than any other opinion. We live in an era of epistemological agnosticism, where the only thing doubted absolutely is the existence of absolute truth. Truth has lost its meaning. What is truth? The modern mind cannot provide a meaningful answer to this perennial question. The traditional conceptualization of truth as the proper correspondence of our judgments about reality and reality itself has faded. Rather, we impose ourselves on the world and subject it to our whims and passions through actions which have little or no relation to the objective order. The ramifications of this relativism are profound. A belief that there is a knowable truth is critical not merely to jurisprudence, but to all conversation as well. This subjectivism makes it increasingly difficult to engage in a public discussion on the meaning of law. The underlying rationale for law is being eroded by subjectivism. The law, which so often enshrines moral judgments made by the community, is challenged by this subjectivism. Today's question is, whose morality is to be enshrined in law? Whose values will the law reflect? Rather than seek the truth about the human person as a sure standard, this debate often derails into legal positivism, where those in power enshrine their own particular value system, one usually held with little or no justification, into law through mere force. Law without reference to truth ultimately gives in to the temptations of power. This legal realism sees law simply as a means to implement whatever social values and behavior are desired by society or a particular group within the social order at any given time. Absent from this equation is any reference point beyond the social construct to overarching truths, or what our friend of happy memory, Russell Kirk, would have called the permanent things. There is no sense of the ought in this legal or social construction. The rules to which this perspective makes reference are not principles understood as guiding rules of conduct, but are merely functionalist or instrumental. The legal positivist Oliver Wendell Holmes opens his work, The Common Law, with the following well-known sentence, quote, "The life of law has not been logic, it has been experience." And then Holmes continues, "The felt necessities of the time, the prevalent moral and political theories, intentions of public policy, avowed or unconscious, even the prejudices which judges share with their fellow men, have a good deal more to do than the syllogism in determining the rules by which men are governed." Close quote. If the essence of law is experience rather than truth obtainable by right reason, the law, enforced through the mechanism of state power, becomes a threat not only to the commonweal, which it is formulated to uphold and protect, but to the very notion of justice itself. The dominance of legal positivism helps explain the existence of so many contradictory and confusing laws. Lawyers are blamed for complicating life, instilling the fear of potential lawsuits and legal battles over even trivial matters. The temptation is overwhelming for me at this point, on this panel, in the midst of this particular discussion, to quote the words that were spoken to Jack Cade by the butcher in Henry VI, Part 2. Quote, "The first thing we do, let's kill the lawyers," close quote. What is generally forgotten about Shakespeare's character and the plot these words advance, however, is that an attempt is being made, orchestrated, to destroy law and establish a dictatorship by killing the guardians of law. The butcher's reference demonstrates the importance of law for freedom. Laws, just and authentic laws, secure liberty and ensure human rights. The practitioners and experts of such laws who seek the truth are friends, not enemies, of the civic order of virtue and freedom. How do we come to the generally poor conception of lawyers that pervades in the land today? I suggest that it results from a distortion of the function and limits of law due to the growing epistemological agnosticism with regard to the apprehendability of truth. In the same way that the law must be related to truth in order for justice to become a reality within the commonweal, so too must power be related to justice to prevent its exercise from decaying into coercion. Positivistic approaches to law are diametrically opposed to the notion of civic law as a reflection of a higher natural law, which is its beacon, its source, and its goal. The natural law has been traditionally understood as the source of all human law. Contemporary jurisprudence, tainted by relativism, rejects the natural law tradition. Definitions of the natural law extend back to antiquity. As I'm sure you know, Cicero says that the natural law is, quote, right reason in agreement with nature, of universal application, unchanging and everlasting. There will not be a different law in Rome and at Athens, a different law now and in the future, but one eternal and unchangeable law for all nations and for all times, close quote. St. Thomas establishes both the linkage of civil law with moral law at the same time that he delimits the civil law's capacity to implement the whole of natural law in the following passage from the Summa. Quote, human law is law inasmuch as it is in conformity with right reason and thus derives from the eternal law. But when a law is contrary to reason, it is called unjust law. But in this case, it ceases to be law and becomes instead an act of violence. And then he goes on, every law made by man can be called a law insofar as it derives from the natural law. But if it is somehow opposed to the natural law, then it is not really a law, but rather a corruption of the law. Close quote. The natural law, inscribed in the human heart, served for centuries as a standard by which to meet the demands of justice and the measure by which to craft human law. Today's relativists see the natural law with its objective moral standards as a threat to human freedom. It is ironic that the relativists absolutize human freedom, thus viewing any moral norms as an imposition on human liberty. I wish to turn my attention to this misconception which lies at the heart of the rejection of the natural law tradition. Natural law does not insist that all of God's demands be enshrined in positive law. It does not set the stage for a new Constantinianism, a reamalgamation of church and state. Natural law reminds us that there is a higher law in the universe, a set of transcendent values that limits the power of government to intrude into our lives. Natural law is an anchor for both our rights and our responsibilities. Not every moral obligation need be conscribed into positive law. To do so, indeed, would damage morality in a subtle but powerful way. When a person is confronted with a true moral obligation, say, to aid a person in distress, the obligation presents itself as a rational and absolute demand which addresses the whole person, intellect, heart, and will, to dispose himself in accord with his nature as a rational creature. Moral obligations address themselves to free persons. There is, contrary to the opinion of relativists, a preservation of human freedom even in the presence of an absolute command. Positive law, on the other hand, has a coercive nature. While law has the potential to appeal to the whole person in a rational manner, it also carries with it the threat of force, and so it has the potential to unjustly limit human freedom. Relativists, in their rejection of the natural law, deliver themselves over to the ultimate tyranny of positive law without foundations. Without natural law, we are left with legal positivism and its accompanying administrative boards exercising fiat power. This would subject our society to the possibility of tyranny by human caprice. In fact, much of this approach has already been enshrined in the bodies of laws and the legal approach that justifies much of the ever-expanding welfare state, wherein the minimal requirement of justice, which is do not do unto others what you would not have others do unto you, this has been confused with the sublime command of love, do unto others what you would have others do unto you. Once this happens, and we see its evidence around us every day, the delicate interplay between rights and responsibility become confused. And we forget that someone may have the right to do X without everyone else having the responsibility and justice to guarantee that X is achieved. Our modern welfare state, indeed our entire culture, with its fear of requiring any kind of religious values and moral standards, is a clear example of how this confusion becomes institutionalized. The reaction to Justice Scalia's speech in Mississippi, wherein he called upon believers to be bold in their public profession of faith, illustrates this point. Barely had the justice delivered the speech than the likes of Barry Lynn of the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State and the Washington pundits Richard Cohen and Art Buchwald questioned Scalia's objectivity in being able to decide religious cases that would come before his court. Now, by this standard, people of faith are not to draw upon their beliefs when contributing to public affairs. Only those who believe nothing at all, except for a doctrinaire attachment to legal positivism and the uses of juridical power, only they can be objective. This view is not merely an attack on Christianity or religious faith, but it is an attack on reason itself. By this logic, any assertion of the capacity of the human mind to know the truth makes the claimant biased. The natural law, with its appeal to objective standards and its reliance on the truth of the human person, offers a profound dissent against the relativism of our present times and the damage it brings. I propose that a revival of natural law jurisprudence is necessary to end the current paternalism in American politics. In conclusion, the natural law implies that encoded into the human reality, there is a message, as it were, from its creator, a message containing the truth about the human person. Part of this truth is that we are only free in light of the absolute standards to which we must conform our liberty. The Judeo-Christian tradition, with its resounding rejection of relativism, understands that in revealing the moral law, what people of faith seek to do with their insight into truth is to be able to propose it to others, not impose it upon others. In the Old Testament, we see God bringing the tribes of Israel out of bondage and uniting them to himself through the Sinai covenant, which contains the basic precepts of the moral law. This covenant was completed, as Christians believe, by the new law of the gospel, which Scripture describes as an interior law, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. By the way, that was St. Paul, that wasn't me. As a new and interior law, the gospel teaches us, both by enlightening our minds and by instilling a love and affection for the truth. The truth of the Judeo-Christian revelation, which reveals the truth about man, serves as the sure foundation for all human law. Let us focus our attention on ourselves and allow our very human nature to instruct us in the ways of peace and justice, and thus reconstruct the connection between law and truth. Thank you very much.